Okay, let's get started. Call the meeting to order. Welcome to the Early Childhood Learning Finance Committee. First of all, I want to thank the members that were able to go on the tour. I thought the tour was very interesting and helpful for understanding what actually happens in a child care and what is going on a day-to-day basis. There was a great photo in the Pioneer Press, Representative Eastland, I hope you saw that, with Representative Eastland and Representative Peterson and myself, a little bit of me playing bingo with the kids. And so I thought that was a nice, a good follow-up, and also to, you know, here at the legislature that we are getting out and learning about programs firsthand. So it was a good demonstration of that. That was the objective of that day. Today, our objective is to learn more about the school readiness assessment we've been hearing so much about, and the members that are on the, Carlos Mariani's E12 committee. We know we heard about this already this morning, so there might be just a little bit of overlap for you. We're going to have first the Department of Education talk about kindergarten assessment, and we're going to have a actual teacher that is going to talk about how she works out the assessment in her community, Nancy Wallace. Dr. Karen Ephraim is here to talk about her views on the assessment, and then the Human Services Department is going to talk about the child care service agreements and kind of measuring quality and how you do readiness assessments in younger kids. So with that, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We'll work off of the two handouts. You have the copy of the PowerPoint in your packet. And then the something that looks like this, which is the actual assessment that we'll be talking about. And then I think you have books, too. Fortunately for you, I'm not going through the books, but you have that for reference. This is the fourth year we are doing the developmental assessment at kindergarten entrance. And so in the PowerPoint, you'll see some numbers that refer to year two and year three. We're in the fourth year. We're just getting the preliminary numbers now, and probably late March, probably we'll have those numbers, so we can certainly keep you up to date then on the changes in that. But we've seen relatively small change from year to year. So, on the first page of the handout, we just have the purpose of the study and why we got into this in the first place. And obviously, we got into it to get a statewide picture of children's school readiness at kindergarten entrance. We want to better understand the achievement gap, the initial, if there was an initial achievement gap. And then we wanted to learn about risk factors that were associated with children who didn't come to school fully prepared to learn. So let me just say a couple of things about the assessment before we go any further. And as you can see, there's I think there's 32 items on this checklist. Remember, we're talking about young children. They just turned 5 to enter kindergarten. The assessment is done within the first 6 weeks of kindergarten. By the kindergarten teacher. It's not a one-time assessment. She does it over, does it over a period of maybe the whole 6 weeks, maybe, you know, half that time, whatever. But she looks at the child, according to these 32 items, she looks at that child more than once on each indicator. And Nancy Wallace will tell you more about that from a teacher's perspective, but it's important to remember when you're looking at these results that it isn't just a one-time thing for each child. The assessment is observational. The teacher observes the child over time and may observe how the child exhibits the indicator through different activities. So it isn't that she's putting out the same activity in front of the child time and time again, but there are different activities to get to the exhibition of the indicator. The following page is our definition of school readiness, really, which is just telling you the domains of development that we look at. The approaches to learning, I'll give you a little definition about it. Approaches to learning can be thought of as attitudes, behaviors, and learning styles that children use in acquiring information. So that might be a term maybe you haven't seen a lot before. The next slide then is the, how the scoring. And again, if you look at your assessment, you see three little pencil boxes here. And I just want you to have these definitions here because I think this is what gets a little confusing sometimes. The child would get would be scored as not yet if that whole time that the teacher was observing for that indicator, the child never showed that skill or behavior. If the child intermittently showed it, one day he did, the next afternoon he didn't, then he would be scored as in process. The teacher would know that the child had that knowledge, but wasn't reliably demonstrating it time and time again, which is how you would get the proficient rating. So that gives you a little kind of just a definitional.
Ms. Carlson, well, two things. One, I'm going to stop and get the minutes approved, but then I did want to ask you a question specifically about that.
Okay.
Let's see, Representative Wardlow, did you get a chance to read the minutes?
I just about memorized them, Madam Chair.
Okay. But thank you.
Not quite.
Would you like to
But
them?
I do move we approve them.
Thank you. Representative Wardlow moves approval of the minutes for January 25th. Is there any discussion? Okay. Hearing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Okay. Motion prevails and the minutes are approved. Ms. Carlson, I had a question about, you know, we're in committee this morning, we're having a lot of discussion about what you were talking about, which is the sort of not quite ready versus, you know, that. So where you get the 50% and then the
that
breaks down into 12%, are you going to talk about that more?
Yes,
as we,
Madam Chair. Look at the next slide, actually.
Okay.
Is I think that will get to a good way of seeing how these numbers get added from left to right or right to left or whatever. But, okay, then now you'll see all the domains that are part of the definition of school readiness to the left. And this is these are year two results. So look across them. We have the, let's take the language. We mostly have talked in Representative Mariani's committee and this committee about language and literacy and mathematical thinking. If you look at those numbers, and you heard the commissioner this morning in the committee and before talk about how 12% of the kids scored not yet ready in the language development and literacy area. Then you see the biggest chunk of kids, 46%, are in process. So those are the kids that have been, those indicators have been showing those intermittently. And then there's 43 that are proficient. What some of the reports do is add the in process percentage to the not yet. So you get 58 of the kids over 50%, and then they're called not ready. But that's what the commissioner was trying to make that point, that we're looking, the kids that aren't ready on that indicator really are the 12% of the kids that haven't exhibited that behavior or skill at all. We actually modeled after the state of Maryland, and they've been in this business, I don't know, probably 8 years now or something. And they right away and over again guarded that, you know, said you have to guard against people saying, you know, X percent aren't ready for kindergarten. It's because you see that it isn't as simple as a composite score of not ready. There isn't that, and you have to go domain by domain. Then the next two slides are the major findings, and I think I kind of talked about them this morning, too. But you get a little more detail here. So this is the level of maternal education. We found the two biggest risk factors that contribute the greatest to the not yet scores are low levels of maternal education and low household incomes. So you'll see here that in all five domains, the students of mothers with the least amount of education, which was defined as less than high school, were 2 to 8 times more likely to have a not yet average rating than kids of mothers with a bachelor's degree or more. And one of the things that is really a difference in, according to this finding, is the size of children's vocabularies, and the level of maternal education has a lot to do with the receptive and expressive language, the number of words kids use or understand when they hear, and that's kind of fascinating research, actually. The next finding is the household income, and you'll see that this isn't quite as compelling as the maternal education level, but it is our second most compelling finding, and that is that those kids were 2 to 4 times higher to get a not yet rating in the lowest income category. The next few slides are just kind of a summary of what has happened because of this study. And as I said, we're in our fourth year, and we're finding that, and you're finding that, you're hearing it all the time. Everybody's sort of talking off the same score sheet. Now, they might be talking slightly different and interpreting it, not consistently, but it's the baseline that most people now are talking about. So that's certainly different than would I be sitting here 5 years ago. We wouldn't know this and be able to talk at all about a measurement common to the state's kindergartners. We also have, I think the study has done a lot to drive the points to people on the street that kids at kindergarten age, preschool age, really their development is very variable. They come to school with, and no news to teachers, but they come to school with an array of knowledge and behaviors, and they certainly are very different from one another, and that's sometimes the greatest challenge for kindergarten teachers. And I think the study has also shown us that there needs to be an appreciation of all the areas of development, not just of academic development per se. And then the last slide talks about how, and this is what Ms. Wallace will tell you more about, that we've really been able to have some important messages about teaching practices as a result of the study, and you can see those that, you know, this helps helps teachers identify kids' needs earlier than they had been doing, and also it's a great way to communicate child status and child progress to parents. Once teachers have assessed children, they have a better idea on how to plan their curriculum and improve their classroom instruction. And it's very useful in parent-teacher conferences. So a lot of teachers have told us that they use it for that. So so that's a hurry up through the study, and you can ask me any questions.
Why don't we see if there's questions? I just have a question. Could you remind us the different samplings that you used? You've done this for 3 years, and you had one, the first sampling, I think, was random. The second one was targeted, and the third one, then we... Can you
actually
explain?
The first two were random. The size increased some over to the second, from the first year to the second year. The third year was a strategic sample. It wasn't a representative sample. It was a strategic sample. We were asked to take entire districts, and then we stratified them, and that way the districts then had... The purpose for that was so that communities could have results of their own children, so to speak, and so we tried that for 1 year. But it's not a representative sample, but the trends, the scores weren't very different.
What was the change in the numbers from the first year to the second year?
I think that's in the book, isn't it?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the first year we had around 1,000 children in the study, and the second year we had around 3,000. And 3,000 is about 5% of the population. And the results you were just looking at in your PowerPoint are year 2 study, which is a representative sample.
And then we went to year 3, and then we skipped a year because it wasn't funded, and now we're back,
right.
And this year we're going to get the results maybe during the legislature?
Yes.
Year 4, right?
Mm-hmm.
And now how many, I just wanted to get a reference point, how many kids would be sampled this year?
We did a 10% sampling this year.
Oh, how many kids would that be?
About, 10% would be 6,000, but we didn't have that many participate.
Okay. Correct, because of the session ended and school was out, so we weren't able to recruit a large enough sample. Next year we'll have a 10% sample.
Okay.
But this is a little larger than year two study. And actually, it's interesting, year three was also about a little over 3,000 children.
Thank you. I think the member's just trying to get a reference point. Mm-hmm. I mean, ideally, you'd have all kids assessed, so you'd really then wouldn't have to statistically stratify it. You would actually know where the population was at. But it does cost a certain amount of money to administrate the test. We have some members that have questions. Representative Wardlow?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was looking at the slide where you said kids are 2 to 8 times more likely to have a not-yet average or and in the other slide about 2 to 4 times according to income, education-related income. Makes a little bit sense there because it seems like the higher the education level, the better the income is. But I was just curious, do you have a breakdown of why these kids don't score the way they should? Is it because they spend a lot of time alone, not being played with, so to speak, or is it because the parent just doesn't interact with them like they should because they don't know any better? Or do you have any feel for that?
Madam Chair, Representative Wardlow, no, we don't know that. We just know that the income, you know, we just know the demographics. We don't know the reasoning behind there, so...
Ms. O'Sullivan, we need you to introduce yourself for the tape.
Oh, I'm sorry. My name is Barbara O'Sullivan. I work at Department of Education and Early Learning Services.
Thank you. We have a question from a Representative Eastland.
I have a couple questions. One was one that I'd asked the other day, and maybe I can reword it a little differently. If we're using this assessment as a predictor for success in school or school readiness, and we've been doing this now for 3 or 4 years, have we looked at the first group to see if how they are performing in third grade matches how we predicted they would perform?
Madam Chair, Representative Eastland, no, we haven't. Let me remind you, this is done at kindergarten entrance, and it's not necessarily done to predict school success. It's done to show how kids are coming into kindergarten. A big issue, and you might remember there was a bill at one point in time in Representative Sikora's committee, and I think it made it to conference committee, to do that, but there was kind of a hefty price tag to it. And one of the reasons is in kindergarten, first, and second grade, we have no benchmark tests for kids. So they would be going from this, you know, relatively simple assessment all the way to the third grade MCA. And assessment people, our testing people certainly and others, just advise one against doing that. That's too big a leap in and too variable development to make that leap from entrance to third grade. Now, if we had kindergarten, first, and second grade tests or assessment, then I think we could do it from year to year, but to leap over that is too much.
Representative Eastland?
Well, I mean, it may be a lot, but there's lots of different opinions about the speed that children are ready to learn, and the catch-up factor and the fade factor, and all those kind of things that we kind of talk about. And I guess the issue that I think would be really important to know is if we're using this assessment to determine that a child isn't ready for kindergarten, I think the implication is then they're probably not ready to learn. But if this is not a good indicator of whether or not they're ready to learn, and because they seem to progress no matter where they fall on here, I guess that's my question. I think it seems like we would like to validate this a little bit, and I guess my question is how do we do that? How do we know this is a reliable way to tell if a child is ready to learn and ready to progress in school?
Madam Chair, Representative Eason, I didn't mean to imply this wasn't a good indication. If we did this again in kindergarten, and there are these assessments are available for kindergartners, first graders, and second graders. If we did that each year, the leap is too much to do it at age 5 and then not do it again until age 9. So we could certainly do that, but we'd have to do, you know, you'd have to pay for the assessment is what happened. The cost kind of killed the idea. It's very tempting to go from this entrance to the MCA, but it's not advisable to do that. So if we had 3 years of testing or assessing in between there, we could do it from year to year. Representative Eastland?
Yeah. I guess that argument does not seem like it makes total sense. It seems like if kids are ready to learn, it ought to be noticeable when they're in third grade as well as second grade as well as first grade. So if that's the point in time that we have an assessment that we could use it, it would be interesting to see where these same children are that took this assessment are on the spectrum of their progress in school and find out if the ones that weren't ready are the ones that turn out to be lower performing and so on. It's just that relationship that would be interesting to look at. We don't have to go any farther. Clearly, we don't have an answer to the question. The other, I got another question. It's in this book. And it was on page 33. It is a graph in there that shows averages for children by gender. I guess there's kind of an alarming thing in here that I'm looking at that is prevalent in a lot of things in our schools. And that is when you get to the proficient categories, boys are significantly less proficient than girls. In process, boys seem to be a little higher, I guess, or relatively close, maybe a little higher. But I guess, could you speak to that issue a little bit and tell me why that would be occurring?
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, Representative Eastland, it's national research also validates this in terms of the difference in gender in proficiency, actually, because every finding we have, we always go back and look at the national research to make sure we're in line, and we do. And it's just a different rate of development. And what we really need to do is then look at the boys in high school, too, and what happens in between there to see if they catch up.
And Representative Eastland, on page 52, that in the recommendation section, mm-hmm. there's some references to other studies on gender differences.
Okay, I have some more
Representative
questions.
Eastland?
Go ahead. Okay. Is there others that want to ask questions?
Yes, so we have two other members that want to ask questions. If we can do those two, and then I think we'll bring the teacher up and talk about that, and then we'll take some more questions. Representative Winkler?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, we'll just continue in part with the dialogue begun by Representative Eastland. As I look at two of the functions that you could have for these assessments, one would be to assess the readiness of students coming in and thereby assess, in a manner speaking, the readiness programs that we are providing the state and over time get an idea of whether we're getting better results. And another purpose could be to establish a baseline for kids in kindergarten and show their progress over time. And I think that in part goes to what Representative Eastland was talking about. Are you saying that this assessment is not a meaningful place to start as a baseline for students coming into school?
Ms. Carlson?
Madam Chair and Representative Winkler, no, it's a great place to establish a baseline. Actually, that's one of the findings. But we need to then assess again at the exit of kindergarten and then in first grade and then in second grade so that the assessing is consistent so that kids aren't indicating readiness to learn and then we're waiting 4 years to test them again.
But I suppose you
Representative Winkler.
I suppose there would be some value in maybe at least doing one in between entering kindergarten and third grade or something. I mean,
yeah.
We wouldn't necessarily have to do it every 3 months. Because the implication from what I'm hearing is that the more you test, the better in those years. But I guess the follow-up question then, if the funds were available, would it be possible to increase the reach of these assessments and to target more and more kindergarten students and use it not just a tool as kind of a a snapshot in time of what's going on, but to actually use it for individual students as kind of a baseline as they move into those classes.
Ms. Carlson?
Madam Chair and Representative Winkler, yes, absolutely.
And Madam Chair, just one follow up to make sure I understand. But your statement was that it was not advisable to do that?
It's not advisable to take the entrance. This kindergarten entrance assessment, think of it as it's your way to know if the child's skills that he was supposed to acquire at age four during his fourth year are evident. And so at entrance to kindergarten, you're seeing that those are evident. Then you want to give him some benchmarks of that his five-year-old knowledge is evident, his six-year-old is that, so that you're not going all the way to, at age nine, developmentally, kids are in a way different kind of concrete operational period than they are at the pre-operational period. And so it's just, you don't want to have the stakes so high on this entrance test that that's the predictor of the third grade test of success. But you could certainly do, if there were resources to do it, you could do it for every kid, and hopefully you would do it that way, and the teacher would use it for every child as the baseline then to manage the curriculum and the progress of each child.
Representative, sure, would you indulge me in just one more? Another brief line? As I remember, you can correct me, but the rough expenditure was about $287,000 to do this 10% sampling. And that presumably, simple math would say that 10 times that amount would get you to every student. My assumption would be it would be substantially less. But do you have an estimate for a cost for doing every student?
Ms. Carlson?
Madam Chair and Representative Winkler, you must know what I've been doing today. actually, we've been working on a fiscal note for a bill that's been introduced to go to 100%, and the Department of Finance wouldn't let me walk out of here if I told you anything about the fiscal note before they approved it, so I can't. But it is less than 10 times and greater than 287.
Thank you for that helpful information.
That being said, I think that if we will see the fiscal note when the bill comes through, but that gives you a roughly, maybe you could do those calculations and let us know. And so thank you. One more. We'll take, what I'd like to do is have Representative Peterson and then have the teacher, and then first after will be Representative Lane. So Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, is this test meant to be a diagnostic type of test for the use by the teacher during that kindergarten year also, in addition to a screening assessment?
Ms.
Madam Chair, Representative, it's into the definitions of a screen, an assessment, and a test. And then when you talk about the validity, this is a valid checklist that's used to get a picture of children's knowledge, skills, and abilities as they enter school. So it doesn't diagnose, like, as you mean for, like, to do a special needs to, like, create an individualized educational plan. But that's an advantage the teachers tell us they see in doing this so early in the school year, is that they're able to, look at children and say, oh, we have some concerns here, and then they refer them for evaluation. So it's really assessing those skills, knowledge, and abilities that children enter kindergarten with.
Representative Anderson?
I'm still trying to determine how many children are being tested with this. Did I miss that currently?
Madam Chair and Representative Peterson, currently we're doing a sample of 10%.
Okay.
It's a representative sample of 10% of the children across the state.
Representative Peterson?
Isn't it true that most districts have some sort of diagnostic test before children enter kindergarten? I mean, it may not be from the state of Minnesota, but they've either developed their own or they use one of the other tests. I mean, I think I was thinking that when I was in Rochester that they have a pre-kindergarten test that they give. I mean, districts are doing some sort of assessment on their own, aren't they?
Madam Chair, Representative Peterson, actually not all districts do, no. Mm-hmm. And then they kind of vary in the, some districts have them for early entrance to kindergarten where they'll do an assessment, you know, to see if the child can enter earlier. But, and you might be getting into, you know, Ms. Wallace might be better at some of these question answers too.
Well, one final question. It just seems to me that this would be information that a teacher, a kindergarten teacher, mm-hmm. would want to have in front of her or him when they have a student coming in, not as a judgment call about whether they belong in a particular program, but just to say, well, what can I work on with this student? I mean, do they need help in math? Do they need some help interacting? And how do I develop a plan for this child during the year so that they can grow and they can, you know, complete the competencies in these various areas? So I think this is a great tool to have, not as a judgment piece, but more as a diagnostic tool to help a kindergarten teacher to help those students be successful.
Madam Chair and Senator Representative Peterson, yes. And that's what we hear from the teachers who are involved in the study. They, you know, they're absolutely sold on it, on the information that it gives them.
Thank you. Thank you. If we could have Nancy Wallace come up, and then, but if you could sit close for more questions, we'd appreciate it. Members, we have a new opportunity now. We're going to have the vice chair finish the rest of the committee. You know how this committee being at 4 o'clock can present problems at times for the members because family things happen. And I've got to be out at the Build-A-Bear workshop at the Mall of America for my 10-year-old's party that we could only get today. So it's going to be two things. It's a great chance for the vice chair to chair, and I know he's going to baptism by fire, be lenient on him if you can. But also, I will see you at the next meeting.
Mr. Chairman, I have a procedural motion I'd like to know. I think we've met before, haven't we, Representative? Mr. Chairman, I will treat you with the same respect that Representative Slawik did for me when I was chaired the jobs committee last year, so, which was she treated me very respectfully. Didn't do anything mean. So. Having fun. Listen up, everyone.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, first members of the committee, my name is Nancy Wallace. I work in the St. Francis School District in Northern Anoka County. I also, I'm not a classroom teacher at the present time. I supervise the early childhood family ed and the school readiness programs there. I've also done lots of training with teachers around the state of Minnesota on the work sampling system, from which the 32 indicators that Ms. Carlson referred to, they are pulled from that assessment system. And I've done training with preschool teachers all the way up to, through second grade teachers for a number of years. So I'm very pleased to be here today to talk with you a little bit about what I see happening with teachers who are using performance-based assessment like work sampling and like this, like the indicators on this school readiness study, as I've done my work. You know, that process of ongoing observation of children in classrooms has probably been going on for generations. But what we're finding is just that casual observation is probably not enough now. And we really, and that's where a system or a performance assessment like work sampling, it really ratchets up that observation. It really holds teachers a little bit more accountable because there's a structure in place for the teachers to carefully look at each child in a consistent manner and in a focused way so that they're focusing in on the skills that are well accepted for children 3, 4, and 5 year olds to be developing. And then the teachers, if they're doing that careful observation, reflecting on are they moving along in a way that we would want them to be making appropriate development, then they can make some decisions and they can make plans on those observations. Because work sampling or other performance-based assessments are a system and the structure with expectations about what we would expect for young children to do, we come to know where that child's development is relative to widely accepted expectations for children of that age. What teachers tell me who use work sampling in a day-in, day-out basis, what they tell me is that doing this ongoing observation within a structure makes them better teachers. Because they know the because they're observing children over time and in multiple situations, they watch for the skills to emerge while they're doing reading time. They watch for the skills to emerge while the children are maybe on the playground or during gym time in a multiple settings, like Ms. Carlson said. They not only discover what the child can do, so kind of that yes, no, they can do it, but they also discover how they do it and their learning styles and who they are as a learner. And it helps develop those relationships between the teacher and the child because the teacher really gets to know the children at an individual level. And that's really helpful for when the teacher steps into the planning mode of what are we going to do now. So the teacher has gathered all this information about the child as a learner, where their skill level is, what skills are just emerging, kind of in that in-process category, and which skills are proficient and not yet and all that. And then the teacher looks at curriculum or lesson plans, and it doesn't matter if it's a curriculum that they've purchased from one of the publishers or if it's one that they've developed over time in their program, they make modifications in that curriculum. So it's really, really responsive to where the children are at a particular point in time, and they can bring them forward in their development in a really meaningful way. Along with that, I've also had parents report to me that they were amazed how well a preschool teacher who only sees a child maybe two or three half days a week, or a kindergarten teacher who might only see that child half days, how well they knew their child and how well the teacher could support information or goals they were setting for that child because they had this ongoing observation and they could track progress over time and talk about what they knew about that child. With teachers who use work sampling, they also say that they adapt their curriculum and lesson plans based on that information, and like I said, it makes that learning more responsive. They say they get a truer picture of the child than if they only tested them three times during the year by asking specific questions. And this, I think, is especially true for children who are learning English or those who have special needs. Sometimes those children don't show what they know in the way that children who maybe have lived in Minnesota their entire lives do. And so by being keen observers and watching for the nuances of learning and how children are showing their learning, teachers really do have that true picture of children. In fact, some teachers who've worked in programs that only do testing of children and didn't do ongoing observation tell me that it was easy to ignore those testing results, and those are the ones where you kind of maybe pull the child out in the hallway and ask them a series of questions and do little check marks on a piece of paper. Teachers say it was easy to ignore those test results, and sometimes it was difficult to know how to put that information that they discovered through that three-time testing into their curriculum. The other thing is that we have a limited amount of time to work with children, and so work sampling or another performance-based assessment, by definition, it's embedded right in the activities that you do with children. And so you're not taking time away from instruction. Your assessment is actually an instructional opportunity. And with testing, sometimes kids are pulled out of classrooms or major portions of days are devoted to that. Teachers also appreciate work sampling because it lays out those expectations at various ages, and they find that they're more consistent in the ratings with each other because they have this structure. Than if they just kind of went off if that structure or focus wasn't in place. And earlier when we were talking about the school readiness study with talking about kids being at various levels, I just want to reiterate what Ms. Carlson said is that the 32 indicators lay out expectations for children as they're exiting their preschool years, and so kindergarten teachers do have a good picture of where those skills are and relative to the expectations that we would have at various points in time, and then they can build upon that, and just as Representative Peterson said, they can build on that and create those plans for those children in their classrooms. Now, one thing I found that using work sampling, it really improves the quality of staff and the interactions that teachers have with children. It not only heightens their knowledge of child development, but they can use that heightened knowledge right away as they start planning in their classrooms. And they have that knowledge about that they have about children gets included in those daily lessons. And that's a huge part of what I would term quality programs, is that heightened teacher knowledge and improved interactions with children. I mentioned just a couple of ways of how the results of this kind of assessment are used, both with adapting curriculum and creating lessons that are really responsive to kids and thereby impacting what happens in the classroom, and then communicating with parents or others who might be interested in the information. One challenge crops up when you think of using results, and that challenge is, how do we know we have accurate conclusions? This doesn't only apply to work sampling or other performance-based assessments or the school readiness study. It's true with any assessment we use with young children. We know that 3-, 4-, and 5-year-olds are very poor test takers. And if you have 3-, 4-, or 5-year-olds at your house, or if you know a 3-, 4-, or 5-year-old, you know they have their own agendas, their own personalities, their own timelines, and they don't have the personal skills to sit for testing sometimes, and sometimes they lack language skills to truly explain what they know. They also haven't learned the social skills or the social rules for test taking. So with any assessment of young children, we have to recognize the limitations of the data we have. So with work sampling or other observational kinds of assessment, we might wonder about the quality of the observation that the teacher did. And we might wonder about the conclusions the teacher inferred from those observations. Are they really accurate? Is that child really demonstrating a proficient, or is it really in process? We wonder about those kinds of things with performance-based assessment. With other testing, we might wonder if the testing day was a good day or a bad day for the child. We might wonder, did they sleep well last night? Did they have breakfast this morning? All those things can impact how a child might behave on a particular day. We might wonder if they felt safe with the person administering the test, if it was a stranger. We do get a number lots of times with various tests. We get, and that's nice and clean, and we know that we can look at a chart and see where that number falls. But sometimes what we forget to do is we forget to look behind that number. And how was that number arrived at? If it was poor input because the child was tired or hungry or maybe a little sick, we might not have the confidence in that number. If we knew that, we might not have the confidence in that number that we might think we have. So on the one hand, the results are reliant on teacher skills with performance-based assessment to appropriately observe and then draw conclusions. And on the other hand, the results are reliant on a 3-, 4-, or 5-year-old to reveal themselves in a short time span to someone who's asking a series of questions or wanting a specific series of tasks done. And so we just need to be aware of that limitation with whichever way we are looking at assessing young children. I know, you know, from my perspective, as a trainer of people who do work sampling or other performance-based assessment, I know I can't change the test-taking ability of 3- to 5-year-olds to any great extent. You know, that's just part of child development. But I can change the skills and knowledge of the adults working in the classroom so that they become better observers and they can collect the most robust data possible through their skills. And then by doing that, that translates into better, more intentional interactions with children in their daily activities and curriculum. I just provided a bit of information about performance-based assessment here, what teachers tell me about what they see as the benefits for the children in their classroom, for themselves as teachers on a journey of even doing better job with the children and in quality program development. And I just want to thank you for this time.
No. Well, thank you for your testimony. I appreciate what you had to say. As a teacher myself, I'm glad that you kind of painted a picture for us how that interaction between the looking at the work and the observations that you make that are perhaps could have been anecdotally recorded or whatever.
Right.
So I think you did a really good job of describing that, and also raised some of the concerns that you might have as a teacher about, are you really seeing the true performance? So, are there questions from members? Carolyn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And as far as, I think you clarified for me some of the difference between work sampling, testing, assessment, because we usually look at these things and say it's a test.
it's not a test. And then we say it's an assessment, and we use that word rather loosely. It's not even an assessment. It's a work sampling. And I guess I would just ask you to, again, clarify that more specifically, that we are just we are teaching the adults how to bring, get quality answers from their assessment, their observations of the child in action.
Right. You know, you're right. Assessment is like a very confusing term. And sometimes we mean that really narrow diagnostic almost look. And when I've been talking about assessment, I'm talking about in a broader sense, anytime we want to gather information about children. The thing with performance-based assessment systems, and they're using assessment in the broad sense, is that with broad-based observational systems, what we're doing is we're looking at children in the natural context of what they're doing on an everyday basis. But those systems have a structure to them, and they lay out pretty clear expectations for children of various ages. So teachers will observe in an ongoing manner, and there's a whole training for how to do that and be specific and focused and still do all your teaching tasks. But teachers will observe, and they collect those observations in a variety of ways. And then at various points, like for the purpose of the school readiness studies, it was after about that mid-October time. If you're doing it a year long, usually you'll do it maybe every trimester, maybe every quarter. You'll stop and you'll look at those observations, and you'll hopefully have several observations related to the same expectation or indicator, and then make a determination on where that child is. And there's a whole criteria that goes along with a performance-based assessment system of this is what proficient means, and it kind of lays it out. And so as you improve teacher skills at observing, so they're doing good data collection, but also at understanding what that criteria means and how children may demonstrate it in typical classroom activities, then they make the ratings they make, you have higher confidence in them. So that training and that improved skill level leading to better results for kids, is they're kind of all rolled up in one.
Representative Wardlow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know if I have a question or not, but this is what I heard you say. And this test, if you will, kind of reminds me of my own classroom days. We always had a test or a quiz to monitor what they were doing, and that allowed you to apply correctives during the time as you help them. And I see this as it allows the teachers to have a personalized, individualized plan for each kid, for each child. It allows the teachers to compare notes on the what works and what doesn't work, and they themselves grow after that. It also tells them something specific to tell the parents. It's nice to have something to say when the parent shows up. And, you know, we talked about the three R's, and it was mentioned one time about the fourth R, relationship. And I think this is crucial. This assessment, whether it's valid and reliable or not, the fact that it gives the teachers something concrete to look at as they look at every child individually, it improves the relationship the teacher has with that child because they can interact in a more meaningful way. And I think the biggest, most critical thing that happens to make education mean something and grow is the relationship with the child and the teacher at any level. If the teacher relates to the child or the student as a person and knows what they need and can provide it, it just magnifies their effectiveness. And here's my question. I knew I had it. Remember I asked about the parent who's home, or the child who's home a lot with the parent or someone else, or isn't, maybe sits around a lot. Do the teachers, I'm sure when a child comes into their program, they learn a lot about their history. And so even though it's not a scientific study, do the teachers learn where that child came from and how that child spent its time? Whether it was sitting playing with blocks and nobody cared what they did, or sitting watching a reality show next to mom or grandma or somebody. any feel for that? I mean, I know it's not scientific, but maybe that would help you to ask.
Ms. Wallace?
And I'll quit.
Okay. Ms. Carlson, you feel free to
try it.
Okay. Okay. I think it's pretty usual for most programs or schools to have like child information sheets that parents fill out. I think if you talk anecdotally with teachers, they'll tell you that they can kind of tell the kids that have had exposure to various kinds of experiences and maybe have participated in a variety of different activities and that have been read to rather than put in front of a TV or whatever. That kind of emerges just because of their skills in the classroom and because of their vocabulary and just their awareness of the world around them. So I think they can pick it up kind of anecdotally, and then, you know, depending upon what kind of information sheets or whatever that the school kind of asks at the beginning of school.
I have questions from Representative Gottwald and Eastland, and I think we'll have to move on to our next presenter, but Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Vice Chair. Testifiers, I'm wondering how, it's building a little bit on Representative Wardlow's comments, but is this tool used, for example, you mentioned anecdotal evidence about what environment they're coming from, and one of my big concerns is how we connect with the parent-family-home relationship and the school relationship because of its impact on student achievement. Do the results of this ever get shared with parents from a perspective of here's where we see your child performing? Can you participate in reinforcing or building them towards the higher level of achievement and preparedness for kindergarten? Is it used in that way, or is it simply used as an assessment one time? And
if you're referring to the 32 indicators. And that sheet that the kindergarten teachers fill out. I think that might vary from district to district as to how it's shared. If you're talking about if a school or a program is using work sampling or another performance-based assessment throughout the year, certainly that would lend a lot of support to talking with parents and explaining, you know, we're noticing your child's doing very well in the math area, but here in the reading area, and you could support that by, you know, and laying out some examples. I think across the state of Minnesota, our early childhood programs are very good at that, and there's a lot of literature out there to support that effort, as well as in the early elementary schools with, you know, schools have parent nights and, you know, just handouts that go home. Lots of them are using technology, the internet, and so forth to get those ideas across. So,
but yeah. This is not used formally in a connection with parents.
It can be, and I think it would be an individual decision as to, like, if you're referring to that 32 indicator checklist, that would be like an individual school or maybe even teacher decision.
Representative Eastland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I got a couple of questions here, maybe a comment. I guess the first question, this isn't related directly to what you talked about, but it's just I'd like to know, when in the process of early learning do we start to identify learning disabilities?
Mr. Chair?
Go ahead, Ms.
Wallace. Representative Eastland. In my experience, we begin identifying learning disabilities. Now, I'm not talking about the label LD, but conditions that might interfere with the child's learning. We start identifying those at birth. There's a whole early childhood special ed, there's a whole program, and that starts at birth. And, you know, there's a variety of ways that service is provided, and then on up through the ages.
Mr. Chair. And when do the labels start to appear?
Ms. Boss.
Those labels, if you're thinking of like learning disabilities and that, probably in elementary school, we don't see that too much in early childhood for the most part. From time to time there may be one, but it's more prevalent as you get into elementary school.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, one more comment I'd like to make. Or just an observation, and you can respond if you want to, but it's just something that I'd like to just comment to the committee, because it's a concern that I have. I'm kind of going back to the chart that I talked about earlier, where we see in this assessment that boys are typically identified as being less ready for kindergarten than girls. If you look at our educational system as it moves along, what happens in elementary school is boys are labeled at about a 4-to-1 rate of having a learning disability over girls. When you look at children that are under some kind of medication, which is quite common, boys are the ones that are almost always on Ritalin when you look at the comparisons. And I guess my question is if you look, just one more observation, if you go back to when I was in college, and this is not a scientific observation, it's just an observation. When I was in college, on the college level, it was about a 60-40 split male-female. Today, it's about a 60-40 split female-male. What we're seeing all the way along the process in the educational system is we're seeing boys and young men are achieving less and less and less. And here at the earliest entry point now, we're identifying boys as not being ready. And my question is just more of a philosophical question is, are we recognizing the differences that exist between boys and girls when we do these kind of assessments? Or are we starting boys on a track for failure right out of the chute?
Representative Eastland, there is research that shows that in some respects that, you know, the skills needed for school favor some of the skills that girls have that boys don't, or that boys express them differently. Maybe you could look at some of that research and might answer some of your questions. Are you trying to?
I guess I've looked at the research. I guess what I'm looking at is what we're doing, and I'm hearing nothing in what we do that even acknowledges that difference that research shows that exists. And so, I mean, that's my question. When we use an assessment like this, and we know that there's a wide range of readiness, age, gender, there's a whole bunch of things that play into this equation, and we're using a assessment that is supposed to be universally accurate for and cover all of those things, are we really recognizing that sometimes for just plain genetic reasons, because he's a boy, he's going to be less ready to sit down and be in a learning environment that is really more conducive to some other kids. I just think that's an issue that I think if we're going to get down to this level of being scientific about education and what we need to do, I think we need to talk about that issue and understand that issue. Because as a father, I had one boy and two girls. They were grossly different. And I observed it, and we dealt with it differently, but I don't see anything here to see we're even trying to deal with it at all or recognize it. And as we go into the system, the boys are being penalized because of it.
Do either of you have any comments?
Mr. Chairperson, Representative Eastland, I guess I can only speak from my own personal perspective and the involvement that I've had. I know there is an awareness of that boys and girls learn differently, and I know there's been lots of training for teachers. I think probably the best resolution to that is how that gets brought into the classroom and how teachers utilize that learning that was provided for them and, you know, reflect on that and figure out how are they going to respond to boys maybe in a different way than they respond to girls, or provide different opportunities so that they can show their learning in different ways that are appropriate to the two genders.
Thank you.
That's my only response.
Thank you. We'll move to our next testifier then. Dr. Karen Ephraim, is she here? Thank you.
Thank you,
please,
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, would you please identify yourself for the tape and begin.
And members of the committee, my name is Dr. Karen Ephraim. I'm a mother of three, a pediatrician by training, and a policy analyst with EdWatch and three other national organizations. And I'm here to thank you for your concern for children, but to talk about some of the other data that you may not hear as much, and to raise some questions and concerns for your consideration, particularly right now about the kindergarten readiness assessment, and its validity, its reliability, and how it's being used to make policy decisions. We've been having a lot of discussion in this committee as well as in the E12 committee about what percent of children are not ready to learn, whether it's 12%, whether it's 50%, and how to make decisions regarding policy and finance and programs for early childhood based on those kinds of numbers. And Ms. Wallace and Ms. Carlson actually helped make my case quite well. They stated, for instance, that some teachers do the assessment immediately at the beginning of kindergarten. Some do it over the first 6 weeks. There's really no uniform way of that I heard, and maybe I'm mistaken, but that I heard of how it's done. And so to get an assessment of children when one teacher does it in one day, and one teacher and another teacher does it over several days, when one teacher decides that not ready for a particular thing means one thing, and another means thinks something else. And I also didn't hear, and Ms. Wallace did bring up, the concerns about validity and reliability, especially given the interaction, the state of the child at the times that they're being observed, and all of those things. And then Representative Eastland just brought up a very, very important point regarding boys. First of all, let me just talk about the more academic and objective areas of reading and mathematics. I don't know how well you've had a chance to look at the items on this assessment, but even for what are supposed to be academic and objective areas of reading, we have items like gains meaning through listening. What does that mean? And how does each teacher interpret that for each individual child? Or for mathematics, shows beginning understanding of numbers and counting. It's not the child can count to 10. It's not the child can add this group of things and that group of things. It's beginning understanding. What is one teacher's idea of beginning understanding versus another teacher's idea of beginning understanding? And what happens then? How does that play into deciding that a child is not ready, in process, or proficient? And what are we then doing with that data on these pretty subjective items to make major policy decisions for the children and the finances of the state? And it gets even worse when one looks at the socio-emotional area. The approaches to learning, Ms. Carlson defined as an attitude. That's not very objective. shows eagerness and curiosity as a learner. Well, that's a nice thing. And relationally, that's a nice thing for the teacher-child interaction and something to maybe talk to parents about. But it's a whole nother thing when you're going to pronounce a child not ready, in process, or proficient. Multiple experts and groups such as the World Health Organization, the Surgeon General, the National Center for Infant and Early Childhood Health Policy admit the difficulty of accurately assessing children, particularly in the area of socio-emotional or psychosocial development, due to rapid developmental changes. In fact, a 2005 report from the National Center for Infant and Early Childhood Health Policy report on infant mental health, 0 to 5, admitted, quote, broad parameters for determining socio-emotional outcomes are not clearly defined, end quote. They also admitted diagnostic criteria for infants are still being validated and developed. And they also admitted, quote, a lack of longitudinal outcome studies. So you have even the experts questioning how valid and reliable these assessments are, and yet we as a state and you as policymakers are talking about millions of dollars and the placement and the work of what's going to happen with these children and what kind of programs are going to use on stuff that really doesn't have very much validity, reliability, or scientific or academic agreements. And Representative Eastland brought up his concern about boys. If you look at the item that says shows empathy, shows empathy and caring for others. That's a really good thing to know. But little children don't do that very well. And boys, and I'm speaking as a pediatrician, do that a lot less well than girls. And that speaks exactly to the kinds of concerns that Representative Eastland is bringing up.
Dr. Ephraim?
Yes.
I'm sorry to interrupt you. We did get started late, and we don't have very much time left, and we do have one other test. Could you wrap up with your...
Absolutely. So the concerns that we have are that not only boys, but poor and minorities who are already, according to federal data, being over-identified for special education have the potential for being wrongly or falsely labeled with this kind of assessment and potentially drugged. And we have a lot of evidence that there's been a 300% increase in the use of psychotropic drugs in 2 to 4 year olds. 2.5 million children in this country are on antipsychotic drugs, the youngest being 18 months old, according to a study from Vanderbilt University. Poor and minority children are also being drugged more than children in HMO settings and in school settings, and that is a very real concern. So I would just say, please focus on the academic basics. Focus on things that you have validity and reliability about, and don't make big decisions based on really vague and subjective criteria.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony. Thank Members, you. Are there questions? Representative Lane.
Well, I don't want to, Sharon, I don't want to speak for the state people, but my understanding was when you started that the teachers were measuring this differently, one day, 1 over 6 weeks later, one with certain criteria, one with another criteria. My understanding from what they said, it was very clear. They had a period of time to do it. a very specific way to do the observations. And training the teachers was a key part of the program so that they would be getting quality observations. I didn't hear what you heard.
Do you have a response?
I have looked at the booklet, and I heard what both Ms. Carlson and Ms. Wallace said, and I didn't hear a specific protocol for how often and how much these children are looked at over the assessment period. And if it is, I would be happy to see that.
Representative Gatwell.
Mr. Vice Chair, just as a response to Representative Blaine, I think the question and the reason that this is important for our committee to focus on, I won't take a lot of time, I know we're trying to move on, is that we need to be realistic about what is and isn't represented here. Even the department people in private conversations with myself have acknowledged that there may be some issues there, that it's not a perfect science, that we don't have an assessment tool that is absolutely apples to apples and crystal clear and black and white and perfect. So as we look at these numbers and try to base policy decisions on them, we need to acknowledge that reality. I wouldn't throw out the assessments. On the other hand, I wouldn't, you know, we got to be a little careful about how we judge these assessments. And again, some of the points the testifier made about the ambiguity in the questions and the fact that they're not worded as objectively as they might otherwise be. It's just something we need to be aware of. I don't think it says let's throw out the data or let's rely exclusively on it, but we need to be aware of it.
Thank you, Representative Gatwell. Representative Winkler?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just would look for a quick clarification. So is it your suggestion that these kinds of assessments can't be improved and should be thrown out, or they should be recast or modified or improved in some way? And if neither of those is true, then at what age is it legitimate to begin to look for assessments of development, which is another way of saying, you know, academic progress or any of the other kinds of terms you use?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Winkler, what I'm trying to say is that we have groups in the state that are saying that 50% of our children are not ready to learn, and they are asking the legislature to spend millions and millions of dollars to expand programs, to expand testing, to expand outcomes that don't have a great deal of validity or effectiveness. And all I'm suggesting is that, yes, we can use those kinds of assessment as a baseline for individual situations and that kind of thing, but to label 50% of our children as not ready is an exaggeration that should not be exploited to expand financial policy or power interests.
President Winkler.
Mr. Chair, one quick follow-up. So this apparently is really the only data that we have on this, and so I guess the implication would be that we shouldn't do anything to improve or expand early childhood learning in this state until we have a better measurement? Because I guess I just don't follow. Either we should take the best information we have and act accordingly, or we should basically say we don't have good information and therefore not do anything.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Winkler, if I had more time and maybe at another time at the committee's convenience, I'd really like to talk about the effectiveness of various early childhood programs. The incidence of concern by experts of actual harm to academic development and socio-emotional development of spending too much time at too young an age away from one's parents, and the long-term situation that basically, I don't give just one statistic, at fourth grade, in international comparisons of reading, math, and science, United States fourth graders outscore their universally preschool peers in those tests. It is not until eighth grade and then 12th grade where they fall to the middle and then the bottom of the international academic heap. So it speaks more to perhaps not a need for more preschool as much as making some significant repairs to K-12. And the number of children in K-12 or in preschool programs has increased significantly since 1965, and yet our standardized test scores, like the National Assessment of Educational Progress, have essentially remained flat. So if preschool is that wonderful, why hasn't there been an improvement in the test scores? That's what I'll leave you with, and I'd be happy to talk to you about this in more detail, and I have lots of quotes and references if you are interested.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that the past two speakers have, or the representatives have expressed some of my views, so it's fine. Let's go on.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. We have the Department of Human Services, Deb Swenson-Klatt, but since we only have about 5 minutes left, members, would you like to stay 10 minutes because we started late, or should we ask them to come back another time? What's the preference of the committee? Are you willing to stay? Okay. All right. Why don't you come up? Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Deb Swenson-Klatt with the Department of Human Services Child Development Services Unit, and I will try to be as brief as possible. You have a handout of PowerPoint notes and then several other handouts that I'll just try to describe briefly to you. And our goal here today is to talk just about the Department of Human Services perspective within the child care programs on early childhood assessment and the use of child assessment in child care settings. We are particularly interested in supporting the use of appropriate assessment both for the purposes of ensuring that parents are supported and empowered in their partnership with their child care provider, given that so many children in Minnesota are in child care settings that spend so much time there. We want to ensure that child care providers are given and supported, given the skills and knowledge and supported in those skills and knowledge in the same ways that Nancy Wallace talked about. Child care settings are education settings as well as other early childhood programs. So that kind of support for training as well as the use of assessment in for purposes of research and program evaluation are the two the ways that we try to that we come at child assessment in child care programs. I want to emphasize that the Department of Human Services child care programs view the definition of child of school readiness in the same way that Department of Education does, that we have been involved in using the work sampling system tool also in several, in both training and in research and evaluation and program evaluation. So we have a shared agency perspective. If you look at the first slide, this is just emphasizing information that's already been shared on what child assessment is from our perspective, that it's an ongoing process of collecting and interpreting information about children's development. This is, again, our approach that we're taking when we work with child care providers and when we look at how to use research on child assessment in child care settings. The third slide just emphasizes, again, the use of child care, child assessment from our perspective. Again, empowering parents, informing caregiver practice, and providing a tool for research and program evaluation. One of the handouts that might that looks like are just coming around is an example of a tool called the OUNCE scale, which is another kind of performance-based assessment that is related to work sampling and we have begun to find very useful for working with infants and toddlers. If you glance at that tool, you'll see that it contains some checklists that really guide the observation of caregivers as well as parents. It's really designed to be to help create a partnership between parents and caregivers as they support a young child's development. The fourth slide is a here we're providing an example of one of the indicators of progress, one of our early learning guidelines in Minnesota for ages 3 to 5. One of those guidelines says, initiate stories in response to stories told or read aloud. This is a developmental indicator that that is in the early childhood indicators of progress. And we show this example in order to, on the following slides, show how a tool like work sampling connects to that indicator. So the work sampling indicator that helps a caregiver understand and observe for whether or not a child is achieving the early childhood indicator of progress is gains meaning by listening, an indicator that Dr. Ephraim referred to. And if you just glance at those next three slides, you'll see some very specific definitions of how the caregiver or a teacher would look for proficiency in that for that indicator of gains meaning by listening. I just point that out because there is very clear guidance on what it means to gain meaning by listening in the work sampling tool. I think I'll skip over a couple of these other slides just to touch again on how we're using the child assessment, how we're supporting the use of child assessment from a training perspective. As you know from previous testimony that we provided, supporting child care quality involves for us professional development of supports for caregivers, child care practitioners, and one of the many focuses of that training is on supporting the use of appropriate assessment. So we have a variety of training programs in place in Minnesota. I'm on slide 10 here, if they're numbered on your PowerPoint handout. They are focused for caregivers serving infants and toddlers specifically, for caregivers and practitioners who are involved in who are concerned about boosting literacy, early literacy skills. The governor's proposal that was presented last week by the Department of Education to create curriculum on training, a curriculum for caregivers on use of curriculum and observation and assessment will take us much further in our ability to roll this kind of training out to child care providers as well as school readiness programs and ECFE programs. Another way that we have made use of child assessment at DHS in our child care programs is through research and program evaluation. We have a study on school readiness in accredited child care center programs, and you have a handout that's the executive summary of that study. And I'll quickly highlight some of the findings from this study. This study was conducted in 2004 and released in 2005, and it looked at the school readiness in a sample of high-quality accredited child care programs. It wasn't a random sample of programs. It was a pilot study for us. It was our first effort to explore what school readiness looks like of preschoolers in these high-quality child care settings. The sample was 22 accredited programs, and it included 226 four-year-olds in the spring prior to kindergarten entry. And we used, again, the work sampling system checklist, the same checklist used in the statewide school readiness study. And we found that children in the sample of 22 programs, regardless of parent education and household income and race and ethnicity, performed well. So our first finding, you'll see that chart that shows those now hopefully familiar readiness levels of not yet in process and proficient, and you'll see that across all of the domains, the children in these settings performed fairly well. The next slide highlights some other findings from the study. We compared children from the lower income families in the sample to their higher income counterparts, and again, regardless of education level, there weren't great differences in their school readiness. Same for children from different racial and ethnic groups. Another finding showed that the lower income families in this study of accredited child care center programs performed better than children from lower income families in the statewide study that MDE presented to you today. A final finding was that we were exploring through this study was whether and how well child care teachers can use an assessment like the work sampling checklist. And in general, we found that with supports, they were able to implement that assessment. The final, another use of child assessment in our programs is a use that would occur if the governor's school readiness service agreements proposal that we also presented to you last week is put into place. In that proposal, we would use work sampling to assess children over a two-year period in the programs that are participating in that service agreement initiative. I could ask Sheree Katelnik to talk a little bit more about that proposal if needed. But again, here's an example of where we think it's really important to track how children in this type of initiative would do, and it would be our intent to use this kind of an appropriate assessment, a performance-based assessment, to do that. It would allow us, again, to compare to the statewide school readiness results that would be carried out through Department of Education. So with that, I'll stop and take questions. Ms. Katelnik could also respond to questions.
Members, are there any questions? Ms. Wardlaw.
My 11-month-old grandson passed the 12-month test in here.
Thank you, Representative. Any other questions or comments? Would you like to comment any further on? Okay, all right. Well, thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
With that, I think we're adjourned. Thank you.